You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Scheuer was the first chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999, and he continued to work as a counterterrorism analyst for the CIA until 2004. He's the author of several books about America's involvement in the Middle East, and his latest, Osama bin Laden, is a biography of America's Most Wanted. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Scheuer to our show. Hello.
Hello. How are you, sir?
I'm okay. I read that your goal was to base this book on what Osama bin Laden himself has said, not on what others have said about him. How much documentation did you have to rely on?
There's quite a bit, sir. I point out in the beginning of the book, I have in my own archive 175, a few more perhaps, documents that are bin Laden's speeches, statements, interviews, essays, are over 850 pages of material.
And you didn't get these through the CIA?
No. They're increasing. Well, some of them came in when I was still working. But most of them now are available in translation on the internet. They're just not concentrated in one place.
So you didn't have to submit your book to the CIA for vetting?
Oh, everything I write, yes, sir. Even if I was writing haikus, I would have to submit it.
How much was taken out?
Nothing.
What is what you call the Saudi version of Osama bin Laden's life? I guess that's the version that we've been reading from people like Steve Call and Lawrence Wright?
Yeah, that somehow Osama was a good boy, good Saudi boy, who went to Afghanistan and to fight the Soviets, but then got led astray by the Egyptians. And we've bought on to a great deal of that. And of course, Osama.
When you say we, you mean the United States?
The United States and the West generally, sir. Mm-hmm. But really, Osama bin Laden is the poster boy for the educational system in Saudi Arabia. And the only reason they're really mad at him is because he actually attacked one time in the kingdom.
But his family was quite worldly.
Very much
Steve
so.
Steve Call, in fact, in his book, has photographs of the family visiting Sweden.
Sweden, that's right.
And he was educated in Western schools. He dressed in Western clothes for quite a while. So,
well, not Osama, sir. Osama was not educated. He was strictly educated in Saudi Arabia. And there has been discussion that he was in Europe once, and his wife claims that they were in the United States once to get medical treatment for one of their children. But of the bin Laden sons, he was the only one with an education that didn't go out of the Middle East.
Now, were you saying this when you were with the bin Laden unit?
Yes.
So were people not reading your reports?
Well, my experience at the agency is that since President Reagan, we've had four presidents who believe that their view of the world is probably the right one, and intelligence is less important to them. But more than that, I think it by using the term terrorist, you automatically put the individual into a box where he can't possibly have anything worth saying. And so a great deal of what the enemy has said, which would be helpful to us, has been ignored.
Well, as we said, his family was quite worldly and wealthy.
Yes.
How did he become such a staunchly religious Muslim? You say he was educated in
Saudi Arabia,
where Wahhabism is the dominant form of Sunni Islam.
Yes.
Was he educated as a Wahhabi?
Well, he certainly was outside of school. He went to a school in Jeddah that was a westernized school. He learned history and in science and mathematics and languages. He speaks some English. So he's his educational experience is much different than his brother's, but also not completely unworldly, if you will.
Wasn't his first serious mentor a member of the Muslim Brotherhood?
Very much so. Abdullah Azam, who was a Palestinian member of the Muslim Brotherhood, was one of the few Islamic scholars who went to Afghanistan to fight with the Mujahideen. And bin Laden, for a time, was his he was bin Laden's mentor, and they were partners in running a non-governmental organization to help the Afghans.
I mentioned the Wahhabi branch of Islam. Is this uniquely Saudi?
It's uniquely Saudi in that the whole country is basically been educated in a Wahhabi version of Islam.
Does it differ much from other types of Sunnism?
It's much less tolerant, much more martial, really.
And it condones violence?
It condones violence in defense of the faith, and that sort of definition can be broadly applied.
So he grows up more religious than anybody else in his family.
Yes.
And how does that lead him to the unique life that he's had? He went against the Saudi government. His family lived off of the Saudi government.
And still does. They just won a $30 billion contract to build 3 more airports in Saudi Arabia. The turning experience for him, I think, was probably fighting in Afghanistan. He is a very thoroughly knowledgeable in Islamic history and grew up with a certain amount of embarrassment that Muslims had not been able to beat anybody in the Western world for 200 years. And so the experience in Afghanistan kind of created in him a sense that the West is beatable.
But he was helped by the West. He was given arms and other forms of aid by the U.S. government because we were trying to help him in the fight against the Soviets.
Well, for my sins, I have spent most of my career in Afghanistan, sir. And when he was in Afghanistan, we were aware of him, but he would not talk to us. He hated us then. And he had his own supplies of arms and money. And we, frankly, didn't pay much attention to him. He was on the side of the angels. He was killing Russians at the time.
But you say he had his own supply. Was that financed by his family's fortune?
It was not only by his family's fortune, but by the families of many wealthy Saudis, Kuwaitis, Emiratis.
Is this before he caused trouble in Saudi Arabia and had to go into exile?
Yes.
In Sudan?
It was indeed, sir.
So to some degree, he was radicalized by his experience in Afghanistan, at least developed an anti-Western attitude. It didn't matter whether it was the Soviet Union or Europe or the United States.
That's right. The Soviets were simply the first target because they had invaded a Muslim country and he was going to go after them there. But his attitude toward the United States since the early 80s has been very negative.
Then what did he do in Saudi Arabia, and why didn't it affect his family?
Well, he went. He returned home a hero in Saudi Arabia as one of the rare Saudis who actually went and fought instead of just donated. And the break point for him with the Saudi government was the Saudis inviting U.S. and other Western forces into the kingdom in 1990 to repel Saddam from Kuwait. And in his view, and I think it's a legitimate view in the terms of their faith, the invitation to Western Christian forces to base themselves in Saudi Arabia was more than he could tolerate.
It didn't bother him that Saddam represented everything that he was opposed to as well in the Arab world?
Well, yes, it did indeed. But his argument was that Saudis and people who had fought in Afghanistan should defend the holy places, not Christians.
So what did he do?
He was under house arrest for a while because he was outspoken, and then he finally moved to Sudan in 1991.
And then Sudan, a country that we would assume would have given him refuge, actually asked him to leave because they were being pressured?
In 1996, yes. He was there for 5 years, ran an agricultural empire, had some manufacturing businesses there in leather and other things. And finally, the Sudanese came under so much pressure from the UN and the United States, not only on bin Laden, but on other activities, that he moved in May of 96 back to Afghanistan.
And how did he become linked with the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban was on the verge of taking over Afghanistan. There was a civil war going on, and they had surrounded the capital at Kabul. And bin Laden donated a good deal of money and also some of his fighters to harden the units of the Taliban against the Northern Alliance, and they took Kabul, and so he became a benefactor of the Taliban.
And helped them all along, including yes. Assassinating one of their chief enemies.
Yes. Indeed, he was responsible with oddly enough, the current speaker of the Afghan parliament, a man named Sayaf, for an operation that killed Ahmad Shah Massoud 2 days before 9/11.
But a just-released report out of NYU by Alex Strick van Linschoten, I don't know if you know about this, and Felix Kuhn argues that the Afghan Taliban have been wrongly perceived as ideological allies of al-Qaeda and that there was a lot of friction between the two groups even before 9/11, and it has intensified since.
Well, that's kind of analysis by assertion, I think. Certainly, I'm not aware of another group or another government that has given up his country to defend a friend. Mullah Omar gave up control of Afghanistan to protect Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden has pledged his allegiance to Mullah Omar. Are there controversies between the Taliban and al-Qaeda? Absolutely. But any cooperation has problems. But
we have two different visions of Islam, don't we? Wahhabism is quite different from the view of Islam that the Taliban practices.
Well, I think it's different from the view of many Afghans. But the Taliban, you have to remember, most of their leaders were educated by the Saudis. The Taliban are really the Saudis without smiles and without any capability in the English language. Saudi Arabia would look a lot like Afghanistan if it wasn't for the Al Saud family.
Is it true that in a 2007 interview, bin Laden said, if you want to understand what's going on and if you'd like to get to know some of the reasons for your losing the war against us, then read the book of Michael Shoyer?
Yes. You can't imagine how many friends that won me, sir.
Yeah, that's not the kind of endorsement that you might welcome. On the other hand, it had to make you feel a little proud.
Well,
you say that he thought was so on target?
What I did was really very elementary, sir, is to take the enemy at his word and to try to explain to Americans what he had said and then try to match it to what he had done. We, for example, during the Cold War, paid excruciating attention to everything Soviet leaders said. We translated Marx and Lenin and Stalin and the rest of it so Americans can read about it. In bin Laden, we have an enemy who, not since Ho Chi Minh and General Giap, have we had an enemy who's so eager for us to know what this war is about, how he intends to fight, and how he intends to win.
And he even wanted us to engage in war in Afghanistan, didn't he?
Although
this is something that George Tenet said is not true.
Yeah, he spent 4 years trying to lure us in there. And
why? What did he think would happen? After all,
what's happening now?
Well, the Soviets eventually, but it didn't bring down the Soviet Union.
Well, I think there's always a difference between fact and perception. I think the fact is that it did not bring down the Soviet Union by itself. In the Muslim world, the view is certainly that not only did the Soviet army be defeated in Afghanistan, but it caused the destruction of the Soviet Union. And perception is often reality, and that's kind of the view.
Well, how do they explain what happened in Bosnia, where they didn't win?
Well, they haven't won yet. I think that's what they would say. You know, the Saudis went there when the war started, and they didn't go with guns. They went with kindergartens. And we'll see what happens in the next generation, or if NATO leaves.
My guest is Michael Shoyer, who's written a biography of Osama bin Laden for the Oxford University Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael Shoyer, who was the first chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit. That was from 1996 to 1999, and then continued to work as a counterterrorism analyst at the CIA until 2004. Now, the unit was set up before 9/11. What was the goal at that time?
We were set up in December of 1995, and it was the result of having discovered that Osama bin Laden's name turned up everywhere from the Balkans to Mindanao to Indonesia to Africa. And we decided that it probably was a good idea to get our finger on whether bin Laden was a threat or simply just another Saudi spendthrift.
A Saudi spendthrift, where does he get his money? Does it come from his family? His family, which, as I said, is a lot more moderate in its views, at least on the surface?
On the surface. I think things are never quite what they seem in Saudi Arabia. And I think parts of the family definitely are anti-Osama, but I think it would be Pollyannish to believe that all of the family have turned on him. The money comes from his own money. The money comes from donations. There are still a lot of wealthy Arabs who believe that donating to jihadi activities is something that they're obliged to do.
You stepped down as chief of the bin Laden unit before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes.
Did you continue tracking him?
I indirectly, sir. For 2 years, I was responsible for conducting operations against heroin traffickers in South Asia. And so on the periphery of that was al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And then when I came after 9/11, the day after 9/11, I came back and served as the senior advisor.
Well, many people have talked about how we should have seen this in the works. Were there any signs? Did you have any inkling that something like 9/11 might happen?
Well, we certainly had the intention that he was going to attack us in the United States simply because he said he would. And we had him attack us twice in 95 in Saudi Arabia, attack us in Yemen in 92, in Somalia in 94. He had destroyed two embassies in East Africa in 98, and then almost sunk the destroyer Cole in 2000. So his anti-American intentions were blatant and already painful.
How did you feel about the way our government responded to the attacks in terms of trying to locate him?
I think we did the right thing, but we did it half-heartedly, sir. Afghanistan is not a place where you want to go and stay. You want to, I think, what they called in the 19th century a punitive expedition. The goal was to go there and kill as much of the Taliban and al-Qaeda as we could and then leave with the full knowledge we might have to go back again.
Well, Donald Rumsfeld is blaming everybody but himself for the tactics, but some people have been critical of our dependence on Afghan mujahideen to go after him, people who could be bought off rather than just sending in our own military.
Well, I think that's exactly correct. I happen to be in that time frame in late 2001 at the Washington end of our communication channel. And when our chief in the field, a New Yorker named Gary Bernstein, sent in the names of the people that the generals wanted to use as surrogates, we traced the names to find out what we knew. Both of them had fought alongside of bin Laden against the Soviets and were friends of his. But the generals were really intent on limiting U.S. casualties, and so they went with people who, at least the agency told them, would always be a day late and a dollar short.
When your former boss, the former CIA chief, George Tenet, claimed that bin Laden was shocked by the U.S. response to 9/11, was he not reading your reports?
One never knows, sir, but that clearly there is no evidence to suggest there was shock. The rapidity with which al-Qaeda removed its manpower and resources from Afghanistan clearly indicates they were planning ahead of time. Indeed, bin Laden was so unsure of whether the Americans would take the lure that on the 19th of September he gave an address, 2001, goading us into coming again. He said they still may be too cowardly to face us on the ground in Afghanistan.
To some degree, isn't he being proven right by the struggle that we're now having in Afghanistan?
He got us exactly where he wanted us, sir. And the one thing he was surprised by, if anything, was the lack of offensiveness and audacity. Americans for a long time sat in their camps, and so they couldn't be killed very effectively. But now they're exactly doing what he has wanted them to do, which is to slowly bleed as the Russians did.
Although we seem to be having more of an effect. Maybe we're not. Maybe
no, I think the war is over, sir. I think Mr. Obama has made it clear to the mujahideen that we're leaving. And the whole idea, whether it was Mr. Bush's or Mr. Obama's, that we could somehow put a democratic system into place there was counterintuitive.
Also, well, one man's idea of democracy isn't always the next one, as we're now struggling with in Egypt.
Yes.
Hasn't the United States had a number of opportunities to shoot or to capture bin Laden? I mean, here's a man who is very tall among people who are relatively short.
Yes.
He is reported to have kidney problems? Is that true? Is he on dialysis?
That's certainly the urban legend, sir, but I think that a man who's drunk Afghan and Sudanese water for 25 years would have a hard time surviving that if his kidneys were very bad.
Is it possible that we really have no idea where he's hiding right now?
I think right now that's the case. Certainly under Mr. Clinton, the CIA provided the administration with 10 different opportunities, two to capture him or try to capture him, and 8 times for the military to kill him. And for reasons sufficient to the president, he decided not to do that.
What reasons were you given?
Primarily, they were worried about aggravating the Europeans, making them believe we were gunslingers. They were worried about oil and gas deals that might go awry. In one occasion, we could have killed bin Laden, but we would have killed a prince from the Emirates, and his dad was about to buy $8 billion worth of F-16s.
Well, this is, of course, before 9/11,
yes,
which happened during when George Bush, yes, became president, and we didn't have any opportunities.
No, I carry no brief for Mr. Bush, but the fact is that by the time he became president, bin Laden was moving around so much we could never really pinpoint him, except for the instance where you just referred to in December of 2001.
But he also was schlepping around a bunch of wives, wasn't he? How many wives and children does he have? Big Love in Afghanistan?
I believe he has 3 wives and children with him and 1 wife that lives in Syria.
Likely in caves somewhere?
I doubt it, sir. If he was kind of Mr. Bush's Hollywood version, running from rock to rock and cave to cave, we would have killed him because they're most vulnerable when they move. I suspect he's living a pretty sedentary life somewhere in northern Afghanistan or Pakistan.
My guest is Michael Scheuer, formerly of the CIA. His latest book is Osama bin Laden, published by Oxford University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of his primary deputies, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is an Egyptian. What do you think bin Laden, how do you think he takes the unrest in Egypt? Iran has come out in strong support. Would he?
Well, I think the Iranian support is more or less meaningless. I think that they'll remain pretty silent, but they'll be delighted with what's happening in Egypt. Their main enemies are the Arab governments and Israel. And what's happening in Egypt, what may be going to happen in Jordan, will certainly do 2 things. The successor governments will be weaker than the former. They will be less able to repress Islam. And certainly the successor governments will be not as willing to protect Israel by keeping their borders closed.
Well, is there any al-Qaeda presence in Egypt? Al-Zawahiri was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes. Certainly the remnants of his organization there, and al-Qaeda is present there. But I don't think it'd be correct to attribute to them much of anything right at the moment in terms of being responsible for the demonstrations. I think the more important thing is they're an organization that is tremendously able to take advantage of opportunities.
Can we stray a bit and talk about Egypt for a moment?
Why, sure.
Because a listener wrote in yesterday suggesting that I ask you about what everybody is saying about the Muslim Brotherhood, that they've changed and don't espouse extreme anti-Western and anti-Israeli views anymore. And he says the obvious question is, haven't they changed because they had to in order to adjust and adapt toward Mubarak's harsh anti-Brotherhood policy? And then when there's no need for that, wouldn't it be likely that they would return to their original goals?
That is my view, I think, sir, that the Brotherhood has been in existence for 80 years. It had a military wing at the beginning. In order to not be wiped out by Mubarak, they had to drop the militant rhetoric. They had to drop the military wing. But if you read their most current publications, they are still, like the Saudi government, determined to spread Islam around the world, either by word or by sword. And I think they are an entity that we need to worry about.
Well, is there any way that we could imagine separation of church and state in any of these countries if there is a democracy? For example, Turkey, once it became more democratic, this staunchly secular state suddenly wound up with an Islamist government.
Yes, sir. I think that what we've seen in the Middle East and in the Muslim world generally is that the secularism is a thin veneer. And as long as there's a government that's willing to be very brutal, they can keep that veneer in place. But once that goes, people, naturally enough, I think, go back to their faith. It's much more likely for the Egyptians to hang on to Islam than to go for secular democracy.
Of course, you know, we see that in this country where there are any number of politicians who are claiming this is a Christian country.
Yes.
And that we should be ruled by biblical rules. So we shouldn't be surprised. But isn't there also a problem in what that one man's democracy is different from another man's, and that if you're going to have true democracy, you might very well wind up with Hamas winning the election?
Well, you will.
Or
indeed.
The Muslim Brotherhood.
Almost, you got to be careful what you ask for. You might get what you ask for, sir. And every time we have had an election, whether in Bahrain or Kuwait or in Gaza, the Islamists have won the popular vote. There's no reason to think they wouldn't do very well in Egypt and even better in Jordan.
Are there any qualities of bin Laden's that you've come to admire?
Oh, I think—
Because you've been following this guy very closely.
I think, sir, he is what he seems to be. He's a very pious, very genuine believer in Islam. He is a very good family man, if you will. Clearly, he's outfoxed the United States in terms of strategy over the past 15 years. And in some ways, he'd be a magnificent American politician because he has a message and he stays on message. He has an extraordinary consistency over a 15-year period.
But it's my sense that he's not attracting as many young people to jihad as he did in the past. Is that because he's been relatively quiet over the past year or two?
I think it's two things. Part because he's quiet, but part because most of the Western media doesn't really cover what goes on in the Muslim world. We had two very active Islamist insurgencies, for example, in 2001. We now have about seven. We have an increasing number of young Muslim males in Western Europe and in the United States who seem to be willing to take up arms against our country, even though they were born here. The influence of what bin Laden has done is resonant in the world today, whether or not he says another word. And so I think he has, in his own terms, he has been a success whether he dies tomorrow or not.
There's been a spate of recent books and movies by people who claim to have been close to bin Laden, his bodyguard, his driver. Have any of these sources been valuable to you in understanding Osama bin Laden?
Very much so, sir. They are people who have broken with bin Laden or left bin Laden, but the odd thing about it is none of them have come to support the United States or the West. They admire him. Indeed, they often use the word love when they refer to him. They just decided for one reason or another that they wanted to raise a family or they didn't believe in violence anymore. But they're very, very they're very credible, and they back up a lot of other material about his austere lifestyle, about his leadership by example, the fact that he did indeed engage in combat and was wounded several times, all of the things the West would prefer not to know. These people have helped validate.
I've read that you have recently been training Marines and Army officers about what to expect from al-Qaeda. What have you been telling them?
What I try to do, sir, when we talk to people is to give them the idea that the enemy has a voice and a vote in what turns out. We very often send young intelligence officers and young military people overseas after telling them they have the best equipment, the best training, God's on our side. But we very seldom give them the idea that the enemy will ultimately have a role. And so the role—
This is the same thing the Soviet Union did when they were fighting the Mujahideen.
Yeah.
They felt that they had all the arms.
They had all the technology.
And a mistake we made earlier in Vietnam. Why do we keep on making the same mistake?
It's very endemic, sir. But my job is simply I play a role. I'm identified as bin Laden's intelligence chief. And what I tried to show these young men and women is that there is a massive data that is available to both sides, and it can be processed very differently by the enemy than it is by us.
You write a blog called nonintervention.com.
Yes.
Can I assume that represents your attitude toward Afghanistan and Iraq?
It's my attitude generally, sir, that America has gone too far toward defaulting toward war on far too many issues.
Would that have been agreed to by many of your colleagues when you were at the CIA?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I think a lot of Americans have been raised to believe that we prove the worth of our country by what we do overseas, good deeds overseas rather than at home. I believe, and I'm very much a hawk on some issues. I think in Afghanistan, for example, we haven't done nearly enough militarily. But I don't think Iraq was necessary. In fact, extraordinarily counterproductive. So I'm a person that's, I guess, a nationalist as well as a non-interventionist. If there's a genuine threat to the United States, I think it needs to be destroyed. But we don't need to go, as John Quincy Adams said, looking for dragons to slay.
Well, Barack Obama said pretty much the same thing during the campaign, but he stuck with Iraq.
Yeah.
Can we just pull out? And it seems like our campaign in Afghanistan is, as you suggest, not really working.
No.
Although we do have these momentary victories.
Yes. And that's to be expected into the credit of our people. But Afghanistan, you seize one place and pacify it, you move on to the next, and the enemy backfills. Iraq, I think, unfortunately, when we leave, we will see a sectarian civil war of some dimension there. The idea that a democracy will be preserved, I think, is nonsense.
Well, in that case, we also have the conflict between Shia and Sunni.
Yes, sir.
And this has not been resolved.
No, sir. In fact, the battle lines have been more starkly drawn, I think.
Michael Scheuer was the chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999 and remained a counterterrorism analyst until 2004. He's the author of many books, including the bestseller Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. His latest is Osama Bin Laden, and it is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.